Good evening, everyone. Hope you're doing well tonight. If you'll be turning in your Bibles to 2 Kings 6, we are in the midst of the Elisha narratives that discuss his miracles and his workings with the political parties and all his involvement in that. And last week we looked at chapter 5, which is the account of the healing of Naaman, the commander of the Syrian army. One of the things that I pointed out in that was that in chapter 5, the king of Syria is never mentioned by name, and also the king of Israel is not mentioned by name. And we're not sure, although I did say that it was Jehoram and treated it as if it was Jehoram, and then Ben-Hadad is the king of Syria. There is still some question about whether or not that is actually the case. The fact of the matter is, this section of the Elisha miracles may or may not be presented in chronological order. As I mentioned about the reason why Kings was written, it was not written as just a history book, and neither is Chronicles. They're written with theological perspectives and making theological points, and so it's not meant to be considered as just a straight linear progression of facts of Israel's history during this time frame of the kings. And so it may be that this section is just accounts of various things that happened with Elisha at various times in his ministry, but all grouped together to make the theological point that it's making. Most commentators are going to take the view, though, that it was during Jehoram's reign and Ben-Hadad as the king of Syria. By the way, this is Ben-Hadad the second. Ben-Hadad the first was the one that Asa dealt with several years before. But this is the same Ben-Hadad that Ahab dealt with, and now his son Jehoram, and Elijah and Elisha and so forth. And when we get to chapter 6, we're going to see this again with the of Israel and Syria and so forth, and just the various placements of this and whether or not this is just a collection of stories compiled and, you know, that's put together in one location, not necessarily in chronological order. It may be the case. Just want to let y'all be aware of that. In chapter 6, though, the first 7 verses, we have a seemingly odd story and an odd miracle that takes place by Elisha. And so let's just read these 7 verses very briefly and talk about it. It says that the sons of the prophets said to Elisha, "See now, the place where we dwell with you is too small for us. Please let us go to the Jordan and let every man take a beam from there and let us make a place where we may dwell." So he answered, "Go." Then one said, "Please consent to go with your servants." And he answered, "I will go." So he went with them. And when they came to the Jordan, they cut down trees. But as one was cutting down a tree, the iron axe head fell into the water. And he cried out and said, "Alas, master, for it was borrowed." So the man of God said, "Where did it fall?" And he showed him the place. So he cut off a stick and threw it in there, and he made the iron float. Therefore he said, "Pick it up for yourself." So he reached out his hand and took it. And that's the end of the story. I said it's seemingly odd. Does it seem, at least it does to me, does this seem like an odd story and an odd placement of this story? I mean, why is this in here, and what is the point? Let me hear your thoughts on that. I think that probably our first reaction would be that Elisha or anybody, even though he had the ability to work miracles, it seems like this is too little of a thing to waste a miracle on, if you will. And maybe I shouldn't use the word waste, but to perform a miracle. I mean, it's an accident. Just go in the river and look around with your feet or your hands or something until you pick. Now, I know the Jordan's a muddy river, and you know, it'd be difficult to see down in there, but you would think, okay, well, go get it then, would be my reaction if I was Elisha. But he actually performs a miracle to get the axe head to rise up out of the water. And I think Karen has a very good point that, remember, when you put this in his collection of all of these miracles that are performed, that are recorded for us back to back to back to back, which obviously didn't happen back to back to back to back, even if it is in chronological order, which it may or may not be, this is all making the point that God is with his people and is concerned even about little things. We see him concerned about big things in some of these miracles that are recorded, but some of them are just little things. Well, that is true. Yeah. Absolutely. And in fact, all of these miracles continue to demonstrate that God is with Elisha. Remember, he succeeded Elijah, and they were at first wondering, well, is the spirit of Elisha going to rest, or Elijah going to rest on Elisha? That's very quickly answered through all these succession of miracles, is it not? Good point. Steve? Yeah. This is Elisha's second resurrection. The first one was of the son. He raised the son from the dead. And now he raises this iron axe hand, or axe head, out of the water, raises it up to float. And you say that Elisha is kind of an odd guy. That's kind of the picture I get of the prophets in general, is that these were different individuals. I don't know if it was their job that made them that way or what, but at least the way they're presented in Scripture, they don't seem to be the typical, ordinary kind of person. They're living a completely different life and mission and purpose than most of the other people, and what they have to do to get their message across is sometimes quite odd. James? Right, right. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think, going back to what Karen said, that sometimes we may think, oh, this is too small of a matter for me to bother God with. No need for me to pray about this and ask for God's help on this matter. No, God's concerned about every aspect of our life. Now, you know, we don't need to, let me make sure we understand. Let's not think of God as just a vending machine that we put in a prayer and we get out whatever we want, and we don't use God for that purpose. But he is concerned with those things that are troublesome to us, even if in the grand scheme of things, it may be minor compared to some of the other big miracles that we see that he's involved in. It's still something that God's concerned about. So I think that's probably the main reason it's in here is because every single miracle that Elisha performs is designed to help somebody, whether it be an individual, whether it be a group of people. It's there to help somebody out of their distress. Adam? Even in those mundane tasks in life, God is there and involved. Yeah. Good point. Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly. And then we have another one come up, this time something a lot more serious on a scale. and that is with the Syrians attacking Israel. So verse 8 mentions the king of Syria was making war against Israel. And again, in this section here, we're not told who the king is. And I'm going to go ahead and assume and treat this as if it's Ben-Hadad, because he's been the king this whole time. Again, I don't know if this is in chronological order or not, or some other king, because Elijah's ministry lasted for well over 50 years through a span of four or five kings. So this may be during the time of Jehoram. It may be from some other time frame stuck in here in this section of the miracles. But in any case, you have the king of Syria who has been a thorn in Israel's side for many, many years and is that way through several Syrian kings, not just Ben-Hadad II. And he comes and he's making war against Israel. And what takes place as the king of Syria is moving around his troops? What's the situation here with him and Elisha? Okay, somehow or another, the king of Israel is getting wind of the king of Syria's plans and troop movements. And that, of course, as the story progresses, we see is because of Elisha. Says verse 9, the man of God sent to the king of Israel saying, beware that you do not pass this place. The Syrians are coming down there. And so the king of Israel sent someone to see, and sure enough, there they were. And this happened not just once or twice, but several times, it says. And so in verse 11, you have the king of Syria who's greatly troubled, and he calls his servants and said, will you not show me which of us is for the king of Israel? What does that mean? How would you rephrase that? What is he asking? Yeah, who's the spy amongst us? Who's the mole? Who's the traitor amongst us that is taking our confident information and then relaying that to the king of Israel? How are we getting foiled in this every single time? Somebody among here is a leak. And what's their answer to him? In verse 12, it's not us, it's Elisha. Yeah, Elisha had influence, remember, amongst the Syrians. Remember what he did for Naaman, last chapter we looked at? And was well known, apparently. And they said, nope. It's not us, but it's Elisha. He's the one. And I love how they say this in verse 12. The prophet who is in Israel tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom. So what you're saying in what you think is a private setting, Elisha is hearing and he knows and is then relaying that to the king of Israel. So in verse 13, he says, go and see where he is that I may send and get him. They said he's in Dothan. So he sends horses and chariots and a great army there, and they came by night and surrounded the city. What do you think is kind of ironic about him doing this to Elisha, considering what's been happening? Yeah. If Elisha knew every move you were making, don't you think he's going to know when you send an army after him? Yeah, he's going to know that. And so this great army comes and surrounds them by night. And we have the servant of Elisha. Now, it used to be Gehazi was the servant before, but it doesn't seem like this is the same servant. It may be a different servant. He's not named. And he goes out and he sees this town, this village, city surrounded by the Syrian army. And his reaction is, alas, my master, what shall we do? The next set of verses, I think, are some of the most important verses in Scripture for the spiritual significance, even for us today. Verse 16, so he answered, do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them. Now put yourself in the servant's shoes and try to think like the servant was thinking. How many people does the servant see that's with them? Small company, the minimum that we know about is two. him and Elisha. I don't know if there was anybody else or not. But he's thinking, big army all the way around us, and there's two of us, or let's give him the benefit of the doubt, Tom. Say there's a small number there, small company. Okay. Is the servant's question, is that a legitimate question on his behalf, on his part, to ask? I don't, what are we going to do, and how are we going to handle this situation? And when you say, Elisha, that there are more people with us than with them, I don't quite get that. And so Elisha prayed and said, Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see. And the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. Does this remind anybody of another portion of Scripture, another incident where you have spiritual forces that are fighting, that are probably unseen, but they're fighting for the people of God? Say again? In Revelation, okay. In Revelation, you have pretty much, we looked at last quarter, the curtain being rolled back in heaven to show us the spiritual battle that's actually taking place, that's being played out on earth. And so that is something that is true, I think, no matter the time frame, no matter the conflict, this is always the case where you've got these spiritual forces that are battling. Anything from the Old Testament that anybody can think of? That was Gideon. But in that, I don't get any picture of, spiritual hosts that are fighting. I mean, obviously, in any of this, God's hosts are fighting on his people's behalf. But do you remember when Joshua was starting to conquer the land, when he first came into the land, and he encounters this man who is in battle gear, and he asks, are you for us or against us? And he tells Joshua, I am part of the Lord's army. I'm here to fight on your behalf. And remember, God had told Joshua, had told the Israelites, I'm going to send my army ahead of you. And he speaks of it in terms of like the hornet and so forth, to drive the people out. I'm going to be fighting on your behalf. Now, that's one instance that I can think of where you have this spiritual army fighting, if you will. And the whole point here is to show the servant and us that when we have God on our side, we're not outnumbered. So a pretty striking story that we have here and point that is being made. And then you have opposite effect performed upon the Syrian. The servant's eyes are opened. He sees things as they really are, and he is spiritually enlightened. But what happens to the Syrians? What does Elisha pray would happen to them? They'd be blinded. Now, I don't think that this means completely blinded to where they don't see at all, because you have this incredible army who ends up following Elisha where he's going to take them. But I think the idea here is confused and maybe just kind of out of it a little bit. In any case, they're blinded to the point where they don't understand. They don't get it. They don't see what's happening here. And take a look at verse 19. The army has been blinded, and Elisha said to them, this is not the way, nor is this the city. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man whom you seek. But he led them to Samaria. Now remember, Samaria is the capital city. So it was when they had come to Samaria that Elisha said, Lord, open the eyes of these men that they may see. And the Lord opened their eyes, and they saw, and there they were inside Samaria. And when the king of Israel saw them, he said to Elisha, my father, shall I kill them? Shall I kill them? But he answered, you shall not kill them. Would you kill those whom you have taken captive? with your sword and your bow? And that's a rhetorical question with the answer meant to be, no, you wouldn't do that. You don't kill captives. But rather, in this case, he wants to honor them and give them food and water, set a feast before them. So verse 23, he prepared a great feast for them, and after they ate and drank, he sent them away, and they went to their master. So the bands of Syrian raiders came no more into the land of Israel. Why do you think that Elisha said, no, don't kill them, but give them a feast instead, and then send them back home? I mean, here is opportunity to do away with the Syrian army that came to attack you. And you're going to give them food and send them on their way? Why do that? Kill them with kindness. Okay? I think you're on the right track there. Yeah. Do you think they might have been a little bit humiliated in at least that here they are, they came to capture Elisha. Elisha tricks them, and they end up in the capital city where they're a goner. But then they're released after they're fed. They go back home. Yeah, that they're going to tell the king of Syria what happened. And I think that what Sid is saying as well about kindness. Anybody else thoughts on that? Jimmy? We see this principle in the New Testament through Jesus. Jimmy was referring to, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. But is that typically what happened in days of war? Typically, they would kill the enemy. But apparently, this was a brilliant PR move on Elisha's part. I think that's part of it as well. It's showing, look, we could have done this to you. We could have captured you, could have killed you all, but we're sending you on your way, and we're going to be nice to you. And it says there at the end of verse 23, the bands of Syrian raiders came no more into the land of Israel. So it had the effect that Elisha wanted. James? That is a question that I saw raised several times in my studying, was where is Naaman in all this? How much time has passed? Is Naaman even still around? We don't know. But if he is around, then it kind of makes some sense that he may have had some influence on why they never came back. And, you know, because and even the king of Syria, if this was this same king, would have already known about Naaman and what Elisha did, and here he is trying to send people to Elisha to capture him. Either way, the point got across, okay, we cannot beat Elisha. We cannot beat the God that is with Elisha. Just can't do it. Okay, I have a question for you. In verse 19, Elisha, after the Syrians are blinded, said, this isn't the way, this isn't the city, and the man you're looking for is not here. Kind of reminds me of Star Wars. These are not the droids you're looking for. Is Elisha honest with the Syrians here? The man they were singing was Elisha. They were looking for, I mean, they were told that he was in Dothan, and they came to Dothan, and that's where he was. And he said, you got the wrong city, and you're going the wrong way, and the guy you're looking for is not here, but I'll take you to him. I mean, that's in effect what he's saying. Is he being completely forthcoming with the Syrians? Is he deceiving them in some way? Right, that's true. But he didn't just come right out and say, hey, I'm the guy you're looking for. It was to save David. Okay. Yeah, Jonathan bent the truth some to save David. Michael, his wife, remember when Saul was coming into their chamber to kill David, and he had her make up the bed to where it looked like he was sleeping in the bed, and she said, you know, he's in the bed asleep or sick or whatever, and when he had already escaped and run out of there. We're going to jump ahead just for a moment. Go to chapter 8 of 2 Kings. In chapter 8, in verses 10 through 15, you have Elisha telling Hazael that Ben-Hadad is not going to recover. Ben-Hadad was sick, and he sent Hazael to find out whether or not he would recover or not. And he says, I want you to tell him that he will recover. However, God has shown me that he will die. So he's instructing Hazael to basically tell him something that's not true. And Hazael, in fact, goes and the next day he suffocates Ben-Hadad and usurps the throne. So Elisha tells Hazael to tell him something that he knows is not true. Go to Jeremiah 38. There's a point to all this that I'm going to be making in a question I'm going to ask you. Jeremiah 38. And look at verse 24. The context is the king Zedekiah and Jeremiah are having this private conversation about what's going to happen with the Babylonians coming into Jerusalem and taking them captive and so forth. And take a look at what Zedekiah says to Jeremiah the prophet in verse 24. Let no one know of these words, in other words, that you have told me, and you shall not die. But if the princes hear that I have talked with you, and they come to you and say to you, declare to us now what you have said, and also what the king said to you, do not hide it from us, and we will not put you to death. Then you shall say to them, I presented my request before the king, that he would not make me return to Jonathan's house to die there. Then all the princes came to Jeremiah and asked him, and he told them according to all these words that the king had commanded. So they stopped speaking with him, for the conversation had not been heard. In other words, Jeremiah lied about what they were talking about. He did what the guy said, which was tell them that we were talking about this, when in reality they were talking about that. Exodus chapter 1, here's one that you're probably very familiar with. Exodus 1, and beginning in verse 15, what are the midwives, the Hebrew midwives, told by the Egyptians, by the Pharaoh and his officers, to do with the male babies that the Hebrew women bore? To kill them. What do the midwives do? They hid them. They did not kill them. They saved them. What do the midwives tell the Egyptians when they come and say, hey, wait a minute, we told you to kill the male babies. Why aren't you doing this? What did they say? Yeah, the Hebrew women were, they were so good at birthing babies. I mean, they were just boom, right on out before they could even get there. Sorry, we were too late to the party. Were they telling the truth to the Egyptians? Nope. Not at all. Okay, go to 1 Samuel 16. In verses 1 through 5, you have God tell Samuel to go to the house of Jesse. For what reason? To anoint the next king, which we know was going to be David. Of course, he doesn't know which son of Jesse it's going to be at that point. And what does Samuel say to God when God tells him to go to the house of Jesse to anoint the next king? Okay, but before he's told to take the cow and sacrifice it, what is he concerned about? Yeah, he was worried that Saul was going to find out, and, you know, why are you here? And or why did you go there? And he said, well, I went to anoint the king. No, he doesn't want to tell them that he's going to anoint the next king. He knows that's going to get them in trouble. And so God tells him to do what? Take a cow, sacrifice, and tell him that you're there to offer sacrifice. Which he does, but is that really why he was going there? And was there some deception involved in that? Yeah, he didn't exactly tell him the whole truth, you know, the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. He led him to believe that the reason he was going there was for the sacrifice, when in reality, the reason he was going there was to anoint the next king. And then two other instances in 1 Samuel chapter 21, verses 1 and 2, David is on the run from Saul. He goes to the tabernacle, and Ahimelech the priest is there. He and his men are extremely hungry. Remember, this is where they ask if there's any food there, and Ahimelech says, well, there's the showbread that has been removed from the presence of God, and that's all. But Ahimelech asks, what are you doing here? And what is David's response? What does David say he's doing there, or doing in that area? That I'm on a mission from Saul, that Saul has sent me to do some things. That's why I'm going about. When in reality, he was running away from Saul. And so he tells this lie to Ahimelech. And then in 1 Samuel 27, and in verses 8 through 12, 1 Samuel 27, verses 8 through 12, David's still on the run, if you will, from Saul, and not able to live in the Israelite territory. He's living amongst the Philistines, and the Philistine king is Achish. And David would go out on raids of various Gentile cities and completely obliterate them. I mean, not even take anybody alive. Everybody was killed. And Achish would ask him, hey, so where'd you go today, David? What was David's response? That I'm going amongst the cities of Judah and attacking Judahite cities. Not Philistine or Amalekites or anything else, but Judahite. He was leading the Philistine king to think that he was making himself even more repulsive to the Israelites. And so he lies about where he was going. There's another case where he was potentially going to be captured by the Philistines, and he feigned madness, acted like he had gone crazy. Rahab the harlot, when the spies come in and she hides the spies, she lies that they have already left and they are not with her. Abraham lied to Pharaoh. And who else did the same exact lie? His son, Isaac, about their wives. Okay, here's my question. Here's why I'm bringing this up. Because here in our text, we have Elisha, who doesn't necessarily tell an out-and-out lie to the Syrian army, but he certainly misleads them and deceives them. And in some of these cases that we looked at, they are out-and-out lies. Some of them are just kind of these sleight-of-hand deception type things, misleading somebody. But I thought that the Bible was really, really, really clear that God hates lying. And yet in at least some of these, maybe even all of them, but certainly some of them, this seems to be sanctioned by God and even instructed by God. Is there a disconnect here? Is this a contradiction? How do you reconcile these things? you don't want to be very honest when you're in war with somebody, do you? You don't want to just tell, hey, here's our plans, here's what we're going to do, so you can be ready for that. There are times that I think that we would all understand that in those circumstances like that, in these war times, that you're not going to be just extremely forthcoming with everything. Okay, I think that's a very good point. Anybody else have some thoughts on this? And how it applies to us today? BJ? This was a surprise party for the Syrians. Yes, planning a surprise party. So we had to deceive them long enough to get them to the surprise party. Yeah. Anybody in here ever planned a surprise party for a family member or a friend? Have any of you been kind of caught maybe sometime between a rock and a hard place and not knowing, well, what do I do here? What do I say? Should I say something? Is it okay for me to, as we may say, fib a little bit here to, Trust me, I understand the struggle, and I understand the dilemma that you may find yourself in, and that's what we need to consider. But let me ask you this, compare that to what Terrell said. Not exactly an act of war, is it? Not exactly a circumstance that is going to, that we can necessarily compare to that. Now, I'll come back to that in just a moment. What about Rahab? Go ahead.
This is a touchy thing, but you get into some questions on this thing. But they are attempting to further God's plan, not that he necessarily needs it. So it's difficult for us to try to apply this directly in our lives and say, well, I can buy here or there. So there's that, where there's this overarching strength of God that they're trying to carry on, whether they do that or not. And a lot of them, not everyone in there, but a lot of them are lying for other people, not necessarily lying for themselves. And I don't know that there's a distinction between the Bel David and when he was taking the city, but Jonathan and David, Rahab, and his spies. And there's several of those where it's not for dishonest gain or anything like that. It's for a morally good thing, which is why I said it's a different thing.
And in many of these circumstances, it's literally for their own lives. Or for the life of somebody else. It's protecting human life from being taken when it shouldn't be.
But you never see it happen because they end up as long as they're trying to save themselves or in a bad or to cover themselves for dishonor.
And I think that's an extremely important distinction to make. I think that Adam is right on target there. That these deceptions, acts of deceptions and lies that we see in some of these cases, I mean, it's there to save lives, and it's part of God's plan to further his cause and what he's trying to accomplish. But again, war situations, protecting life, and in some of these cases, there is a greater good here that has to be considered, to where, being completely honest 100% of the time is actually going to be the worst thing to do. And I understand what you're saying about, there is a fine line to draw here. Please do not come away from this class. Let me say this. Don't come away from here and say that Marshall said, oh, it's okay for me to lie anytime I want to. No, and I'm not promoting lying. In fact, the exact opposite, I would say with extremely strongly, honesty is always the best policy. And we need to be truthful people. The Bible is very explicit about that. In the passage in Proverbs where God talks about seven things that he hates, or six things that he hates, yea, seven are an abomination to him. Okay, one of those is a lying tongue. I mean, it is all over the Bible. You don't lie. But there does seem to be a distinction between some acts of deception and some lies and others, which is what Adam is getting at. Rahab and so forth would be, and some of the things we've looked at would be considered in that same vein. Now, even though David out and out lied to Ahimelech, and to the Philistine king, and Abraham to Pharaoh, and his son to Pharaoh. There is no condemnation nor condoning that is mentioned in Scripture. It's just stated as a fact. I bring those up because those are instances of lying that we're familiar with in Scriptures, but I'm not necessarily saying that God condoned those instances. I don't know. And in fact, the one with David and Ahimelech and the priest ended up costing the priest their life. Yes, Rahab was, yes. Can anybody think of a fairly modern day parallel, though, that actually did happen on many occasions during some of your lifetimes? Not most of us maybe in this room, but some of you were living back during World War II. What happened with World War II? Jews and people hid the Jews from the Nazis. And there are many accounts that you can read about in history of where families hid Jews and lied to the Nazis about whether or not they had Jews staying in their house. The greater good there, and I think that that's extremely parallel to Rahab or Michael with David or things of that nature. But there is a major distinction between that type of necessary deception to save life or to do these things that we see here in these kind of instances versus what Gehazi did, versus what we sometimes do to either further our own benefit or keep ourselves out of trouble. Not on the same parallel, not in the same universe. Does that make sense to everybody? Does everybody see that kind of a distinction? And or am I making a or is that a false distinction that I'm seeing here? And am I wrong in that? You know, feel free to disagree. Personally, I do see a difference between things like that and what we have looked at here versus a surprise birthday. I know some people don't have a problem with deceiving or maybe come right out and lying. In those cases, they don't see it as a lie. They see it as, hey, we're just tricking her or him until the proper time. I'm not going to write you up in the Brotherhood papers over that. But it is something that we need to consider, and I can see argument either way on that, but I do see a distinction personally myself. Yes, ma'am. And that kind of goes along with what Adam's saying. We're not in anywhere near the same circumstances as the prophets were of that time and what they needed to do for their missions and for what they were doing. Good point. Okay, well, I just wanted to bring that up because it is obvious that Elisha was purposely deceiving the Syrian army here and to save Israel, to save himself, save Israel, and send them on their way. It says at the end of verse 23, the bands of Syrian raiders came no more into the land of Israel. However, the very next verse, and we're not going to obviously have time to talk about all this, but I just want to introduce it. The very next verse, you have Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, besieging Samaria. Seems like a contradiction there, doesn't it? Between verse 23 and verse 24. That's one of the reasons why many people think that this is not in chronological order, that this is just a collection of stories that happened at various points in Elisha's ministry that are put together in no particular chronological order. Don't know if that's the case. The other explanation is, well, they didn't come in, the Syrian raiders came no more in the land of Israel for a period of time, and then some indeterminate amount of time passed, and then you have Ben-Hadad, and this time it's this time he's named, and whereas before he was not named. So we don't really know about the chronology, but you have him besieging Samaria. And we'll talk about the siege of Samaria, the end of chapter 6, and going into, we'll talk about the end of chapter 6 and all of chapter 7 next Wednesday night. Anybody have any final comments or questions?